Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. I'm putting out a special show this week because I just recorded a very powerful show, and it's so powerful, special, and important that I wanted to get it out soon. My honorable guests are people whose loved ones have been victims of police state brutality here in California, and I'm going to let them tell their stories, but they are Christina Arachiga, Rosemary Duenas, Uncle Bobby, or Cephas Johnson, and Danica Chatma. So stay tuned, and I'll be right back with these courageous and wonderful people. Welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thanks, Cindy.
You're welcome. And so we have a special situation tonight, where we have so far four very special guests on whose loved ones have been brutally murdered here in the state of California by people are so concerned with cop killers. I am more concerned with killer cops. And not just that, but the impunity they have, or at the very worst, they get slapped on the wrist. And so we have on this call Christina Arachiga, and Christina's cousin was murdered by one of these cop killers in Modesto, California. Is that right? That's right, right?
Manteca.
Oh, Manteca, I'm sorry. And I want Christina to tell her story, the story of her cousin, and I know her aunt is also on this call, and she can, tell it from her perspective, too. So, Christina, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and thanks for organizing this. It's a very important topic, and I know it's one that you work 24/7 on.
Thanks so much, Cindy. Yes, it's something that is very near and dear to my heart. As you said, my cousin, Ernest Duenas Jr., was murdered in Manteca on June 8, 2011, and his murderer was a police officer, John Moody, of the Manteca PD. And we're so happy to be here on the show tonight and to be able to speak to your listeners about this very detrimental epidemic that's happening to our communities of police violence and terror and murder. I have been working, like you said, pretty tirelessly, as many of the other families have, in trying to understand what exactly, how this happened, why this is allowed to happen, and why it's continued to happen 2 years since my cousin has died. And so that's pretty much what I do, is organize with other families on a statewide level, organize for my own family, and trying to make some headway with the state of California is what we're working on now, and hopefully changing some laws to make sure that this doesn't happen to any other family. And I'll let my Aunt Rosemary Duenas talk about my cousin Ernest a little bit on what she wants to say about him. But one thing I did want to say about tonight is that I just, I think what you're going to hear from all of us is just really the power of love and what love can do. And, you know, hopefully that people who are listening can understand that, how they would feel if their loved one was brutally lost and everything that they believed in was turned upside down on them with no kind of warning. And whether it be, you know, Trayvon Martin's family, which our hearts go out to them, or whether it be you, Cindy, in your loss of your son in a war that's not, that was not right, in a country that is not fair, or our loved ones who are killed by the police in this police state that we live in. So, I love my cousin, and I'll go ahead and let my aunt talk a little bit about him.
So, Rosemary Duenas, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and please tell us what you're feeling and about your son and what happened to him, if whatever you feel comfortable with.
Okay, thank you very much, Cindy, for having us on your show. My son, Ernest Duenas, was born on August 15, 1976. We lived in San Jose, California, and he played baseball since he was 4 or 5 years old, T-ball all the way till he was at least 16 years old, played PAL football in San Jose. We moved up here to Lathrop in 1989 and hoping, you know, for a better life and better opportunity. He was always very active especially baseball. He loved baseball. He was very talented. He was a talented artist. He loved to draw. He could get a portrait and just draw it freehand from looking at the picture. He just was a character, loved to make people laugh, always had something silly to say about someone. I mean, it's just, you know, he's very much missed within not just us, but his friends, his family, anyone that knew him knows exactly what I'm talking about. He would go out of his way to help someone if they needed help. One time, my daughter-in-law's sister had a flat tire in the rain, and she told him, well, once the rain dies out, come and help me. He goes, no, I'm coming now. And he just dropped everything, went out in the rain and helped her change her tire. He just, you know, he was a good person. He had some issues along the way, but that didn't make him an evil person or someone that deserved to be murdered by John Moody the way he was murdered. On June 8th of 2011, he had a warrant put out for him because he had tested dirty on a drug test and he was on probation. However, after speaking or listening to even to the parole officer at deposition, he said that he was not going to be taken in. He was going to be put in a drug program because he was only about a month or two away from completely being off of parole and would have been free man, you know, from there on. So he knew that he was worth saving. The parole officer himself knew he was worth saving. Mm-hmm. Yet John Moody on that day of June 8th took it into his own hands to murder my son. He was waiting for him. I'm not sure if you watched the video of my son being murdered. It's a police dash cam video that was taken from the vehicle of John Moody. And he was waiting for him at the corner, seen the truck come around the corner, immediately pulled up behind him at the driveway. My son was not driving. He was in the back seat of the vehicle. And as soon as he started exiting the vehicle, John Moody started running up to the door, yelling, stop, drop the knife, Ernesto. You know, Ernie, he would call him. He goes, put your hands up, drop the knife. And they never found a knife near his body or anywhere where he could, you know, could have had reach of a knife. As a matter of fact, I pulled up a news article that the Bulletin posted on June 10th. And in that article, Officer Hensley confirmed that Duenas had advanced on the officer with a weapon in his hand when he was shot. Now, there is no way, you know, he said that Moody was in fear for his life because my son had advanced towards him. Now, in the video, everyone can see that my son's foot was caught on the seatbelt. When he exited that truck, he had only 1 foot on the ground. 1 foot was still in the car with the seatbelt caught on it. Now, how could he have advanced the officer? And contrary, the officer is the one that ran up to my son to start yelling and started shooting immediately. I mean, within, I think it was 4.6 seconds, I believe, that he shot 13 shots at my son, 11 of them hitting him, and several in his back and one in his face. Now, if he was fearing for his life, would he be running up towards my son, or would he be protecting himself, the officer, not advancing towards my son that he claims he was in fear of and that my son had a weapon, and he's yelling through the whole video, drop the knife, Ernie, drop the knife, a knife that he didn't have a weapon. In the news article, it said that he had a gun, then some kind of weapon. I mean, they just kept on trying to cover up the story. You know, Manteca Bulletin is, I feel, is in the pockets of the police department.
Okay.
Because whatever the police department says is what, you know, pretty much they go by. It's their Bible, I guess, as far as what they're concerned. Now, my son, it's bad enough what happened to him, the shooting, but the aftermath is just as bad. Once my son was shot those 11 times, laying there bleeding and dying, Moody went over and tried to pull him away from the truck where you see my son's leg is caught. Starts yelling, "Give me a knife so I can cut the seatbelt. Give me a knife." Another officer hands him a knife. You see him cut the seatbelt from my son's leg. Pulls my son away from the car with my son moaning and groaning in pain. And starts ripping his shirt with the knife, opening that up, and starts sticking his hands in his pants, flipping him over, saying, "I have to find the knife. Help me find the knife. I have to find the knife." Now he's looking for something to justify what he had just done. He had just murdered my son, and now he needed something to justify it. Couldn't find a knife. Flipped my son over as he's dying, and you hear my son in the video moaning and groaning from the pain because he was dying. And instead of administering any kind of aid, all he cared about was finding a weapon on my son. And all the other police officers just standing around. My daughter-in-law had already run out of the house screaming, help him, get him help, and ran to him and tried to help him. And they dragged him away, put her in handcuffs, threw her in the car, and still, they had no help, no help. All you see is them looking around for a gun. So long. I mean, I don't even remember how many minutes it was before he even called for an ambulance to come. The hospital is literally a block away from the incident.
About three
and
houses.
The paramedics. Yeah. I mean, it's that close where he could have had aid in no time at all. None of those officers, and there must have been at least six or more officers that pulled up after when he, Moody said, shots fired, and none of them went near my son to try to save him, to stop the bleeding, to administer any life-saving aid. All they did was stand around and just look and watch Moody violate my son as he was dying. Moody acted like an animal that had gone after his prey and was now skinning him, ripping his shirt off, pulling his pants, unbuckling his pants, looking for a weapon. He had no remorse. He had no. He's an animal to me in my eyes. I feel John Moody is an animal, and it pains all of us.
Terrible.
You know, we released the video so that people can understand. This is what happens. This is the truth. You know, people are out there fighting for their loved ones, and they don't have that. But we want to stand with them, and we want to, you know, be a part of their fight so that we can show the world, look, it does happen. It does happen. Watch the video. It happens. And yet, the DA found it justifiable. And we have a civil case against them in the federal court in Sacramento. And their attorney, you know, of course, they try to have their judge dismiss the case. Well, the judge definitely, you know, he just said, no, there's no way. There's enough here that to show that this officer did wrong. Now, our fight and our struggle is we want to see John Moody go before his peers and be prosecuted for the murder of my son. I know that's the hardest thing ever, but those are the steps that we're trying to take forward by having a civil case.
That's the thing that I am constantly amazed by, is that there's dash cams in many police cruisers, but of course not all of them. But not only that, is these days 99% of the people out on the streets have video cameras in their phone, and so many incidences of police brutality and these killer cops are videotaped, but it's almost, well, it's probably exactly like the cops don't care, because the cops know that nothing's going to happen to them.
Exactly. That's the way I feel. It's like they have their code.
Nothing's
going to
happen to them.
Protected.
Yeah. going to happen to them because of the Police Officers' Bill of Rights, which the state of California was the first to enact in the 70s. Jerry Brown signed it into law, and it basically gives police officers the right to beat you, rape you, or murder you, but there's nothing that you can do. You can't know their history. You can't, you know, a lot of things that we would be able to pull into court to show why somebody would be, you know, guilty of a crime, like their demeanor, how they are, if they're, you know, psycho outside of work, if they're on drugs. We can't do any of that because of this Police Officer's Bill of Rights, and that's one of the main things that we are working to tackle and to make people aware of, because most citizens are not aware that this exists. And, you know, we basically need to just throw it out the window. We need to start over again because what's happening in the police is not working. And, you know, we see more police in the news and being corrupt and being murderers and brutalizing nowadays more sometimes than we even do regular citizens being arrested. There's always a cop on the news getting arrested, and that's because we've just let them get out of control because of this Police Officer's Bill of Rights.
Well, Edward Snowden actually made a comment that people in the United States are more likely to be killed by cops than they are by a terrorist.
Yeah, you're 8 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than you are a terrorist.
Far more likely. So thank you so much, Rosemary. I know this is really hard because, like I said, I go through it a lot, but I think it's very important. And I think it's so important because it's important to tell our stories because, like Christina said, we're trying to prevent it from happening to other people, and it's painful, and, you know, I know the strength it takes to do this. So, Christina, who do we have next?
Next, we have Uncle Bobby, who is Officer Grant's uncle, and he's coming to us from the Bay Area, where he's working on a Trayvon Martin project, so I'll go ahead and let him talk about what's going on with the Officer Grant Foundation and with their family.
Thank you, Christina, for putting this together, and of course, thank you, Cindy, for you know, allowing many listeners to be able to hear the family share their experience, of course, the pain, and of course, our hope to bring about some real change so that other families won't have to experience what we have experienced. I am Oscar Grant's uncle, affectionately known now in the community here, especially in Oakland and all across the United States, as Uncle Bobby. You know, of course, the family, Oscar, and all called me Uncle Bobby, but now, and of course, everybody in the community has come to know me as Uncle Bobby. Mm-hmm. I am, again, Oscar's uncle. Oscar was born on February the 27th, 1986. He was born to my baby sister, Wanda Johnson. Oscar, you know, he was my first nephew. He is a son, of course. He's a brother. He's a father of a beautiful daughter named Tatiana. He's an uncle to his only nephew, which is Leroy, from his sister. He's my nephew. He's a cousin. Of course, he has many friends, and he is a community member. On December 31st of 2008, his mother, Wanda, was celebrating her birthday at my mother's house, Oscar's grandmother's house. At her celebration for her birthday, Oscar stated to her, and by the way, he was there with his daughter, Tatiana, his fiance, Sophia, you know, of course, family members celebrating my sister's birthday. But Oscar stated to his mother that he was going to go to San Francisco to see the fireworks. And she told Oscar, catch BART. You know, it would be the safest way to get to San Francisco and back without any issues with the police and, you know, worrying about drunk drivers. And even if you're going to be drinking, you'll be safe. This way you won't be harassed by the police. The whole reason why she made that statement was for him to be safe. And she thought that he would be safe, as we did, by catching BART to San Francisco. And as we know, for many that have not seen the video, Oscar Grant was killed on January 1st at the Fruitvale BART platform while laying face down with his hands behind his back, crisscrossed to be handcuffed. Officer stands up, shoot him center mass in the back. Bullet goes through the back and through his body, hit the concrete, comes back and punctures his lungs. He dies 5 hours later, or about 6 hours later, at Highland Hospital. What preceded that was there was a call by a passenger on that train that stated that there was a black Hispanic gang fight, which never occurred. This patron made that statement only because he felt that the urgency of the police to get to the scene would be speeded up by that statement, which is in reality what happened. However, Oscar did have a semi-wrestling match with a white guy, a friend or ex-friend of his that he grew up with in the Palmacia area. They had a tussling match. It broke up. You know, it was all done. You know, they went their ways. You know, of course, when the train stopped at the Fruitvale BART station, Oscar and his friends got off the train. Now, this report by this this writer, this commuter, stated that it was all black males. And so the train agent had an obligation to notify the BART Police Department about a possible fight and maybe injuries. The officer that came up on the platform had no idea what these individuals looked like. The train agent had no idea what these individuals looked like. And so Tony Peroni stated that he went on a hunch that these black males that he's seen standing by the train talking were the ones involved in a fight. And so he claimed he wanted to detain them to ask them a question. His detainment was real brutal. He basically shoved them to the wall. Oscar and his friend Michael Griff stepped back on the train as he took Nigel Bryson, Jackie Bryson, and Carlos Reyes to the wall. He came to the train and he started using racial epithet. Well, not racial epithet. He started cussing. He said, "Get off my fucking train now, and I know who you are." You know, and so everyone in the train was like shocked and just surprised that this officer was talking that way. So Oscar steps off the train. He puts his hand behind Oscar's head and shoves him to the wall. So Oscar's next to the wall. He tells Michael Greer to get off the train. Michael Greer doesn't want to come off the train because his officer is really acting belligerent and really just real hard and scary. So Tony Peroni goes into the train, points his taser at riders, and eventually on Michael. Michael stands up. He grabs him by his dreadlocks, pulls him to the train car door. Eventually, he does what he calls a hair pull takedown. He takes Michael Greer down to the ground, slams him. Michael Greer hits his nose all on the concrete, and then he basically jumps on his back and handcuffs him and claims that Michael Greer appeared to have taken a fighting stance is the reason why he did that, which was not true, and it was never witnessed by any witnesses that he took a fighting stance. It was just the brutality of this officer in the course of his doing his so-called duty to apprehend someone that he felt was getting ready to take the position to attack him. Of course, now he has all Oscar's friends, except for a few of them, detained. Sophina is already going downstairs. You know, Tony Peroni then is cussing at him, threatening them. He points his taser. No, Johannes Mesley now comes to the platform. Johannes Mesley begins to cuss at the young men, making threats that he's going to tase them. Even he pointed his taser at Oscar's chest and his groin area, threatening to tase him. Oscar tells him, "Please don't tase me. I have a daughter. Don't tase me." He reholsters his taser. He pulls his taser out later on in the, you know, the display of all the action that was happening on the platform, and reholsters his taser a second time. Of course, then Tony Peroni tells Johannes Mesley at that one, Oscar Grant and Michael Greer is going to jail. Michael Greer is already handcuffed, but Mesley supposedly misunderstands and begins to handcuff Jackie Bryson. After he handcuffs Jackie Bryson, he goes over to Oscar. Oscar is, like, objecting, like, "Why are we going to jail? We haven't done anything." Mesley pushes him down on the top of his head, pushes him back down to the ground. Oscar's on his knees. Tony Peroni then used racial epithets, calls him bitch-ass nigga, and then, of course, Johannes Mesley throws Oscar to the ground. Oscar falls to the ground on top of his arms. His arms are pinned under his body. He's on top of Carlos Reyes' legs. Johannes Mesley is on Oscar back. He weighs 270 pounds. He's 6'7". And Tony Peroni is on Oscar's neck with his knee on his neck with his hand on his face pushing it to the concrete. He actually cracked the bones in Oscar's face before he was shot and murdered. I mean, so Oscar was on the ground squirming. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. His arms are pinned under his body. Carlos Reyes is hollering, "He's on my legs. He's on my legs." As Tony Peroni switched position, Carlos Reyes then is able to pull his legs out. Oscar is able to put his hands behind his back to be handcuffed. Johannes Mesley stands up, then shoots Oscar in the back, and then says to Tony, "I thought he had a gun, Tony. I thought he had a gun." He later tells the other officer that he thought he had a gun. He went on to tell his counselor that he thought Oscar had a gun. He wrote in the incident report that he thought Oscar had a gun. And Johannes Mesley had a history of police brutality with young American men. He was been on the Bart police force for 2.5 years, and at 2.5 years, he had 4 incidents with young African-American men. 45 days before he murdered Oscar, he beat up another young man named Kenneth Carruthers, who also had brought litigational charges against him for that police brutality. This whole case, as people have come to know, was based on Johannes Mesley's state of mind. What was his thought at the time that he actually shot Oscar Grant? And, of course, the defense made the allegation in the defense that he made a mistake by pulling his taser instead of pulling his gun instead of his taser.
Right.
But Johannes Mesley always stated that he meant to pull his gun to protect himself from what he thought Oscar had a gun. So from all of that, we had, of course, a protest in the Bay Area. Everyone that saw the video believed that Johannes Mesley murdered Oscar. We as a family believe that he intentionally murdered Oscar. And so we all struggled with that thought. But it had it not been for the community who pulled out their phones to videotape what happened, Oscar would just be another statistic. He would have been blamed to have had a gun, and we would have been left with that story. But the video gave us reference to what really happened on that platform. And so we as a family are thankful to the community for sharing their videos with the world. We're thankful to the community for standing with the family, embracing the family, loving the family, crying with the family, going back and forth to court with the family, and just utilizing this First Amendment right to speak to that very injustice that they saw. And as a result of all that, it was the first time in California state history that an officer was charged, arrested, convicted, and sent to jail for an unduly shooting of an African-American or young brown or black man. And so we are so thankful that that occurred. It was historical. It was no victory. And as Christina has stated earlier, that the history of Johannes Mesley was prevented from the jury to know because of the Peace Officers Bill of Rights. This piece of legislation allows officers to walk in our community that have a history of police brutality and killing and therefore not be prosecuted, or allow the jury to see their history to be able to make a clear-cut judgment on a decision when it comes back for a verdict. And because they are not allowed to see this history because of this Peace Officers Bill of Rights, 99% of the time, it comes back as a justifiable homicide.
Right.
And this is a travesty to what's happening in our community when it comes to dealing with these terrorist police officers walking in our community. And we, as a family, today have come together all across the United States, but more so in the state of California, in supporting and building with one another so that we can begin to address this very piece of legislation that denies us the right for true justice with our loved ones who have been murdered. And so, you know, I'm not going to get into all what I'm doing right now and what we're doing as families as a united front, but it is important to know that we have come together as families in order to stand to bring about the change that we need when it comes to this piece of legislation and the support of other families that come into our fold that we can embrace, love on, and help get through this sick process. Of course, there's much more that I can say, but I don't want to take up everybody else's time. But I think that this is very important. Again, I want to thank you, Christina, and, of course, you, Cindy, for being a part of this movement that we have going on and shedding light on this heinous act of these rogue police officers that walk in our community. You know, so much love and a big shout-out go to you, Cindy, you know, because people need to know, you know. And I'm going to say this last piece, and then I'm going to let it go. Rosa Parks had went to a rally panel discussion concerning the murder of Emmett Till.
Uh-huh.
And she said when she was on that bus that the reason why she didn't get up, because she remembered that meeting she had went to concerning Emmett Till, a young man, black man, that was a young child, I should say, not a man, that was killed, you know, by these whites in the South. And it was because of that seed that was planted in her that caused her to take that stance that brought about some of the changes that we see today in the civil rights movement. And so we hope, as people listen to this, that a seed is planted in that person, and that person stands up like Rosa Parks and say, no more, no more. And thereby we know when that happens, a change will come. So I just want to thank you, and I'm going to move out the way. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Uncle Bobby. And I understand there's just one other thing that there, I haven't seen it yet, and I apologize, but there is like a fabulous movie about this called Fruitvale that is really inspiring a lot of people, and I hope to see it soon.
You know what? I apologize for not talking about that, but yes, for all the listeners, please go see the movie Fruitvale Station. It doesn't focus on the tragedy, but it focuses on the humanity of all our young men, because you're not going to just see Oscar in this movie. You will see your son. You will see your child, your nephew, your uncle, you know, your brother, your friend in this movie, because it's about our humanity today. We all have a right to life and to be treated with justice and equality. And so
dignity.
Please go see the movie. Yes.
You know, I am probably like very, you know, you all know I'm very politically radical, and but I look like I could be the Republican in the suburbs of some very affluent city. And, you know, I've been arrested now 21, 22 times. And I've been arrested doing civil resistance or civil disobedience. And I know how I've been treated by the police state. And it's been very rough, very disrespectful. So I can only imagine what the minorities and people of color and young people, the way they get treated by, if they can treat me like this and my son is supposed to be a war hero, you know,
right.
I'm not comparing what I go through to what you're going through, but I certainly can understand. So, Christina, what
do you
think next
for us? Cindy, can I say this before Christina take it? I want to say first, I want to commend you for what you've done when you actually camped out. I think it was on Bush or somebody's.
Yep, it's at Bush's rant.
Right, rant. And that, you know what? And I've been hitting and saying that at some point we as families need to camp out on the state building or the federal building to bring national attention to this heinous act of police brutality happening in our community. That was tremendous in what you did, and it brought visuality. I mean, it brought everybody's eyes to that very instance. I believe that that was so critical and that was so important. So anyway, thank you for doing that.
Well, let me know if you guys do it. I'll bring my tent and help you out. And Christina knows that I'm running for governor of California. I'm going to formally announce it tomorrow, but one of the pieces of my platform is to overturn this police officer bill of rights and to invest more money in education and jobs programs than in the prison industrial complex and, you know, the police state. So I'm with you guys. Whatever you want me to do, whenever you want me to be there to speak,
to be in solidarity with you. And then, of course, tell me where you want me to bring my tents, and I'll be there too. Christina, who do we have?
I say that we just kick off your campaign in front of the federal building in our tents.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm down. I want to just touch on something really quick that my aunt and both Uncle Bobby were talking about, and my thoughts on something as I still have it on my mind. But it's the fact that police, you know, what I really want listeners to really understand is that what we were told prior to us getting the videos was something completely different and a complete total lie than what we now know really happened with our loved ones. And I think that's just really important for people, especially with everything that's going on with, like, Edward Snowden and, you know, and Chelsea Manning and, you know, everything that's happening in our country right now. And people are outraged over these things. But these things are happening in every single city across this country. It's not just happening in Iraq where people are just getting gunned down in the street for no reason. It's happening in your city. And it's happened to our loved ones. And so you should be mad that Snowden is being treated as a terrorist and that Chelsea Manning is going to prison. Of course, we should be outraged and we should be, you know, demanding that this does not happen. But this is also happening to people of not just black and brown anymore, but predominantly black and brown, but now people with mental health issues and, you know, and Caucasian people and people of all different nationalities. And that's because we've let it happen to the most vulnerable in our state. And so I just want to just remind everybody that, you know, the things that you're so shocked about on videos happening in Iraq, it's happening right here. And with that being said, I'm going to introduce Danica Chapman, whose son was murdered in San Francisco, and her son Kenny, Kenneth Harding, especially very dear to my heart because it happened right after my cousin died. Mm-hmm. And I just remember seeing the video and just feeling like we literally were in a war zone. There's something so wrong with our country that I cannot believe this is happening back to back. And I love her, and she's an amazing mom. And I'll go ahead and let her talk to you about Kenny. Danica?
Thank you. And it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on here this evening. I appreciate it. Helping getting Kenny's story out. And basically, my son was 19-year-old Kenneth Harding Jr., and I say he was the worst case of stop and frisk, and he hadn't been in the state for 24 hours before he was gunned down and murdered for allegedly evading a $2 Muni transit fare. And this happened in front of a plaza with over 150 people out there and in front of a playground filled with, two playgrounds filled with children that day on a Saturday evening, afternoon, late afternoon. And so my son was denied medical attention and made to lie on the ground for over 28 minutes to bleed out and die, why the police stood over him with their assault rifles and would not give the paramedics clearance to come through to even help him. And they had got on the scene within 7 minutes. And so we're not even from here. Like, I'm from Seattle, Washington, and my life literally changed in the blink of an eye. And after this happened, I had to uproot not only myself, but my daughter, who was 4 at the time, and move us out here to try to fight for what they call justice. But I know better than that. I know there's no such thing. There's just us and how we get up and get out there and fight on the battlefield. So
throughout it all, it has taken 2 years just to in a court order to get any type of evidence released. And for what should have been a ticket offense resulted in murder. And I have since formed the Kenneth Harding Jr. Foundation since relocating here. And we have been feeding the community. Last Sunday was our 19th consecutive month feeding the same community who witnessed this murder. And we're out in the community doing a lot of outreach within the high schools, the community colleges, as well as the universities, just trying to build some type of awareness that this is going on and try to prevent some type of prevention so that no one else becomes Kenneth Harding. And, you know, I was literally thrown into this lifestyle. And so, you know, I feel like, you know, I've already lost my son, but I could try to do whatever it takes to prevent another mother from losing her child. And so that has pretty much become my mission in life. And outside of doing the work, you know, it's all about fighting and standing up for what we believe to be is right, and that's fighting to make sure these children have a future. And I still have an older son left, as well as a grandson, so I have to make sure they have a future as well. So I get out here on the front line with my daughter, and we hit the battlefield doing whatever it takes to go to war to try to prevent another child from going through such a heinous murder.
Oh, my goodness. And it is helping. And I think that the movement that you families are creating is, unfortunately, I'm sorry that it has to happen. And I'm sorry that what brought you all together, but every day I wake up and think, what is and how can we move forward and make the world a better place? And so we have to, I think, live within the parameters of what we've been given or what have happened to us, what has happened to us. And so, you know, I totally understand that not any one of us wanted to be here on this call today. And so, you know, I understand how, you know, how it's like we just do the best we can of moving forward. But I want Christina now to talk about the statewide protest that you're having on October 22nd. And I think it's growing and growing and growing from what I'm observing.
And Ms. Cindy, may I just say, this is Danica, uh-huh. But I would also like the listeners to walk away with knowing that they don't have to just take my word for this, because there was so many people out there that recorded, and
yeah,
there's so many different YouTube videos of my son's murder, and they can go on there and view the murder of Kenneth Harding Jr. themselves and make their own informed decision as well.
And I do want to say that in my newsletter for the show, the podcast, all of those links will be up that I'll be able to give my listeners so they can just, you know, do the research, like you said, for themselves. So we are running out of time, and I thank you all for giving us this much time to tell your stories. But so, Christina, talk about the protests on October 22nd.
Okay, thank you, and thanks to all the families for always being so brave. I love all of them. And we have been, over the last couple of years, and maybe longer, but 2 years is as long as I've been involved in it, developing a California statewide coalition against police brutality consisting of communities course, the families lead the coalition and the fight for justice. So we're actively working right now with about 56 families across the state of California, but that's not even a fraction of the number of people that have been murdered in the state. So we're growing every day, unfortunately, but fortunately that we're making the strides that need to be made to what we know to change the laws. And so on October 22nd, which is a national day against police brutality, we're asking Californians to not go to work, not go to school. And, you know, there will be no business as usual on October 22nd. We're asking for people to take a real stand against what's happened to our families and what could possibly happen to your family if we continue to allow what's going on inside of our police systems and inside of our cities to continue. And so we're, you know, asking everybody to come on out. We have a Facebook page. You can visit my family at facebook.com/justiceforernest, all spelled out. And again, Cindy will have our links on her page where you can come and get more additional information about the October 22nd event. We're going to be having edutainment. We're going to be having speakers. Cindy Sheehan will be speaking. Cindy, will be speaking. We'll be having... of course, Oscar Grant's family will be out there speaking. They're very important to our movement, the strides that they've made in causing officers to be, sent to jail is very important for us. We have another trial coming up, which is the Kelly Thomas trial starts this Friday, and I think they have another court date on the 18th of October, so they may not be able to be there with us, but this is another very important situation. So we're just asking people to come out. We're going to have a march and a rally on October 22nd and join us at the California State Capitol on the West Steps. We're going to have families out there. It's a statewide call to action. And we're hoping to, we're hoping to make some noise in Sacramento and, let them know that we really mean business. And, one other thing I wanted to say is that that Cindy, I, 2 years of fighting this for my cousin, I understand a fraction of what, it takes to get to where you are and how long you've been fighting for Casey. And so for that reason, I definitely am endorsing you for governor and, want to let everybody know that I personally will be supporting Cindy in any way I can in her campaign. And the only way that we're really going to win this all is if we start making some big changes in our governor, and in our cities, and our mayors, and our representatives, and until we do that, then things really can never change, because they're always in control. And so, don't be fooled. This is not a two-party system. It's a one-party system. That's a one-party corrupt system. So, I personally hope that Cindy can get the support she needs to help us change things that so desperately need to be changed in our state.
Well, thank you, Christina, and I just want to thank you all again for doing this. Christina Arachiga, Rosemary Duenas, Danica Chapma, and Uncle Bobby, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we'll get this show out as soon as possible because I think it's important information that everybody needs to hear. My heart is with you all, and like I said, just tell me where to bring my tent or where to bring my big mouth, and we'll get justice for all of our loved ones. So, again, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and hopefully we'll see you all soon.
And, Miss Cindy, thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you.
Well, that was the show today, and I'm glad you listened, and I just wanted them to come from their hearts, and I really believe that my very wonderful guests did come from their hearts, because that's all we have. When we don't have justice, when we don't have peace, we have our hearts and we have each other. So I'd like to thank Christina Arachiga for putting this together and for organizing all of the anti-police brutality events we have here in California. Rosemary Duenas for telling the story of her wonderful son, Ernest Duenas. Danica Chatma for telling the story of her wonderful son, Kenneth Harding. And Cephas Johnson, a.k.a. Uncle Bobby, for telling us really from the heart a story that we well know about Oscar Grant. So, and I'd also like to thank Don DeBar, my engineer, who had to do double work this week to put together this special show, and you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.